Okay, everybody, hi. Welcome back. It's 1 o'clock on Monday, so it's time for Pirkei Avot, History and Hashkafa. We are in a very odd place in the calendar, and it's a place where the topic that we've been discussing the past few weeks really is very most apt. And I refer to the fact that last Thursday was Yom HaShoah, the day upon which we commemorate the murder, really we shouldn't say died or killed, we should say murdered, the murder of at least 6 million Jews from that between 1933 and 1945. And Yom HaZikaron, the day of remembrance of the even more than soldiers, from the time that the first Jew fell in the defense of our homeland in the 19th century until today, over almost, I didn't check the number, it's 23,000 plus men and women, boys and girls. On top of that, we remember those who died in terror attacks. Followed by Yom HaTzmaut, we have for those of us in Israel, this is a very roller coastery type of time, because we reach the nadir of our collective memory and our collective emotionality on Wednesday this year. It's a little bit early because the actual Yom HaTzmaut falls on Shabbos. And then we turn around on the drop of a dime and celebrate our independence. So it's a very touchy time. It's a very sensitive time. And yet, for the topic that we've been discussing, doubt, which is based on our discussion of the Mishnah by Rabban Gamliel, who lived in the first century CE, that Aseh Lecha Rav, get yourself a teacher, v'stalek ma'asafek, and avoid or run away from doubt, v'al tarbel la'aseh u'madot, don't measure your tides approximately, the question of doubt becomes an issue. And the question of doubt is now, because the question of theodicy, the question of tzaddik v'ralo, of why do the righteous suffer, certainly in terms of the Shoah, is a question that never ceases, but arises in all its ferocity in the lead up to Yom HaShoah. And why did so many boys and girls have to die? So many innocent people have to be murdered in terror attacks, just so that we could have a homeland, we have a state, we could have a place to be Jews, in the full sense of the term, not just physically here, but also culturally, and to develop our Judaism in our homeland that was basically guaranteed us by God almost 4,000 years ago. So the doubt is there. Since this is the last time we're going to talk about this mission, we'll go next week, hopefully, onto the next one. I do want to just deal with the last part of the Mishnah, and then we'll go back to the question of doubt, to questions of doubt that that I raised last week. So it says, "Vistaleg masafek ba'al tarbe la'averla," excuse me, "al tarbe le'aser umadot." Don't tithe by estimation. What does that mean? Basically, those of us who live here, and keep kosher, know that the Torah requires that a certain amount of the agricultural produce, and actually the husbandry, the animals that were raised here in the time of the temple, were to be given to the temple to support the Kohanim, who were the priests, who were not only in charge of the running the temple, but also, more importantly, they had the educational system in their hands. They were the teachers. And one of the central elements, one of the central gifts that one gives to that one gives to the priests, and then they could do some to the Levites, and also involved in education. And they weren't allowed to have large territories, and some of it's given to the poor, and there's a whole system of separating these gifts, which are still given, but much more limitedly, because the certain of technical reasons, because of questions of ritual purity and so on, but I don't want to go into that right this minute. But they're tithes. Part of it is 10% of whatever you're doing, or various 10%, portions of 10% of what you grow. And the Mishnah is saying, when you do that, only you have to be precise. Don't let your generosity override you. There are other places to give charity, other places to give tzedakah, where you give as much as you want, or certainly more than just limited amounts. But when it comes to tithes, you have to be exact. Don't estimate it. Use a graduated measuring cup, whatever the case may be, in order to make sure that everything is precise. The point there, the simple meaning of the verse would be that avoid doubts, be as precise as possible, which is a good thing to know. In halakha, it's very funny, or it's very interesting, that you have situations in which there are no limits. You give as much stock as you want. You're not allowed to drive yourself into penury, but the precision is not the issue. When it comes to all kinds of other mitzvot, there are not exact amounts. Other things, however, are very precise. When it comes to, for example, Shabbat, it's a very striking. And when it comes to Shabbat, up until the moment that sunset comes, let's say, nightfall comes, let's say, before that, you can do all kinds of stuff. And immediately after that, nothing. It's really on a dime. It's really very, very precise. And when it comes to trefot, the rabbis like to say that it's really striking that if certain defects are found in animals, that if the defect is at a certain stage in the leg, then it's prohibited. And if it's a higher level, then it's allowed. The other way around. If up to a certain level, it's permitted. But there's a line which is precise, and it's very, very drastic where the line between prohibited and permitted, between required and exempt, between sanctity and sacred and non-sacred is very, 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 very precise. There's no room for doubt. There's no room for estimation. You have to be very, very careful. And as a result, so that's the point over here, that the Mishnah is saying that sometimes doubt, there's no room for doubt because you'll get yourself in trouble. You won't fulfill the mitzvah properly. Or you might get yourself, you might end up violating a law if you're not precise. And there is this precision in halacha, which is very, very striking, which caused Rabbi Soloveitchik, in one of his most famous essays, it's not about him, by the way, but the halachic man, to point out that, in fact, this is exactly the point, that there are many dinim, there are many parts of the Torah which require really mathematical precision. Others not. When it comes to prayer, there's a minimum maybe, but as Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says in the Talmud in Brachot, alavai a person would be able to, or he wishes he could, sit and pray all day long if he had the opportunity. So that's the Mishnah. I want to go back, though, to the question of doubt. We started speaking about it last week. Is doubt a religious category? Is it credible? What's better? Pristine faith, not pristine faith, whatever the case might be. And I mentioned that that there are two schools of opinion, as always in everything Jewish. There are two schools of opinion. One school of opinion is that pristine, simple, uncomplicated faith in God and acceptance of Judaism is the best way to go. It leads to total commitment. It is the force behind which Jews were able to sacrifice everything they had to continue their Judaism because of their total commitment. But that's the case that if there are people who really believe, then don't make them crazy. Don't just let them be, because that's really the best way to be. There was another school, the Spanish school, actually starts in Babylonia, that maintains no, because pristine faith is a wonderful thing, but it also has no antibodies. It has no muscles. It has no ability to be able to defend itself. And if it's exposed to question, if it's exposed to doubt, the doubt will go right through that faith and that commitment like a buzzsaw, because you don't have the ability to really respond. In that essay that I put up on the on my website and on the Tel Aviv International Synagogue Daily Shear thing by Rabbi Nachum Lamb, Norman Lamb, Zichron Livracha, Faith and Doubt, he says something about our circumstances, which I think make pristine faith less attainable. And I'm going to read you just a couple lines, because I think what he said is very germane. Interestingly, he actually notes, the problem itself is based on two assumptions, the propositions on the first page. First is an assessment of the reality of our times. This is not a religious age, nor is it an age of willful heresy. It is an age of confusion. But in the confusion is not that of ignoramuses or of men who change in trivialities. It is a generation which has suffered unprecedented agony as well as a massive intellectual displacement. Now, he's writing this in the 60s. He actually re-endorsed it, went over again, and published it in the 80s. The difference is this is an age of willful heresy. Because the outside world, as I mentioned this last week, imposes itself, invades our space, whether we know it or not, whether we're aware of it or not, and therefore it's all the more reason to, and does not like, it really, the outside world really does not like blind faith. And it works against it. And then he goes on, the next page. So he says. Doubt is thus an integral part of the modern experience, and perhaps may be said to characterize human life as such. A human being must think, and to think is to question, to probe, to criticize. Doubt reflects, here he quotes Paul Tillich, the interrogatory, open-ended, aspirant character of our life. We are naive if we think we can teach Judaism, especially to a young person, without encountering genuine doubt. And the doubts of our contemporaries cannot be stilled by shrillic dogmatic assertions or by charming rhetoric, much less by superficial and artificial solutions which fool no one but their creators. Such problems in faith exist, and we are going to have to meet them forthrightly, whether we like it or not. In our society, amongst genuinely committed and observant Jews, in our children and in our own selves. Indeed, I am more concerned in how we approach doubt when it appears in our own community of the committed than the doubt which confronts us when we engage in a dialogue with the uncommitted. Anyone who was talking... I was actually very gratified with this, because it meant that 55 years ago, Dr. Lamb said exactly what I said last week, that... that the problem of doubt is a twofold one. It's the doubt that we have within ourselves, and whether one can have doubts and have questions and still count oneself part of the Jewish community, part of the observant Jewish community, or does one have to, you know, does that take oneself out of it? And also, do we deal with people who come aggressively at us with questions the same way? Now, obviously, in this... In the short time that this year has, I'm always not going to be able to go into great depth with this. I really recommend reading this essay by Dr. Lamb Zichron Livracha, whose first Yahrzeit is coming up actually. But what I would like to do is, and I don't mean to preach, I really don't mean to preach, because everyone will find their way. One of the things that doubt does is to, if you're constructive, is to push yourself forward to grow and to search for answers. A person who takes a half, sort of a half-baked answer with a half-baked rhetorical flourish by reading books by people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and so on, is just being intellectually lazy. It's interesting, when I read Hitchens and some of Dawkins, I was really, how should I put it? I was really, really disappointed. I was genuinely disappointed, because I found that their attacks or criticisms of God and of faith were so superficial. They're as superficial as, you know, they're as superficial as, and it breaks my heart that this happens. There are real stories like this, that and that's our, and they're our fault, because we teach the superficial positions about religion. I'll tell you a story. Okay. In 1948, the commander of the forces that tried to conquer, that really defended the western part of Jerusalem and almost took the Rova, was David Shealtiel, from an old, actually distant relative of mine, but very distant. David Shealtiel, who was from an old Sephardic family from Hamburg, Germany, raised in a typical sort of like Sephardic but Yekish kind of life, and he had doubts about religion. So one day he took some ham on Yom Kippur, and he went into the bathroom, and he went to another room, and he ate the ham, and he waited. Waited. He wasn't struck by lightning. Oh, there's no God. That's the kind of argument that Dawkins, it's ridiculous. We don't dictate how God responds to us and what we and whether when there's reward. And there is reward and punishment, but we don't dictate how it works. But Shealtiel says, okay, that's it, no more. And he walked out. And I've heard this story from dozens of people. A sort of like fourth grade Hebrew school or second grade Hebrew school kind of view of religion with a sophisticated mind of a person who went to university. Oh, that's got to be religion. That's got to be God. So we're not talking about that kind of superficial thing. Doubt is a religion, but a person who has doubts, it can be a way of driving one forward to growing and searching for truth, because doubt ultimately means that you assume that there's truth. It's part of the problems with today's contemporary culture that there's no belief in truth, but just because they say there's no truth doesn't mean there doesn't there. It just means that they claim that there isn't. As Maimonides says in the Guide for the Perplexed, just because the whole world says that X is true doesn't mean it's true. That's why Rabbi Soloveitchik used to love to quote a midrash in Bereishit Rabbah, where the midrash says, why was Abraham called Ha'ivri? Well, we know because he's Ha'ivri, because he lived. He came from Chaldea. He came from the other side of the river. But the midrash expands and says, and that's not the reason. The reason is, and this is a more existential answer, Ki kol ha'olam me'ayivra zeh v'hu me'ayivra zeh. He took on the whole world because he knew he was right. In the end, he was proven right. Monotheism defeated idolatry, at least until the late 20th century. Now we're in a renewed battle, but that's not the point right now. So the doubt, there's an assumption there is truth. And doubt can be a formative, motivating factor. But as I said, everybody finds their path to how to deal with doubt. I want to get autobiographical, so that I can always say what I have experienced. If it speaks to anybody, then that's fine. If not, then just that's my craziness, not somebody else's. I've learned in my life a few things. Number one, I've learned how much I don't know. And the more that I study and the more that I write, the less I understand. I am painfully aware of the limits of my intelligence. One way of doing that, to see what limit of your intelligence is to try to fathom what it means to travel 10 light years, do the math. Our minds aren't built for that kind of thing. So I'm sort of aware of my own limitations. And I'm always willing to say I don't understand. I can think I can understand when something is really wrong. In fact, I'm sure I know when something is really wrong, but to say absolutely to prove everything absolutely, I can't. That being the case, I can tell you cases of theodicy. My first instance of theodicy, for example, was when my father died. My father passed away it'll be 51 years ago. I was 15 years old, and I had two younger brothers. And he was a very good person. He was a wonderful man. And he had a heart attack and died. And it was a wound, or is a wound, that I've carried my whole life. It's probably been one of the most formative things experience I've ever had in my life. But I never question God, why did you do this? Or get mad at God, because I don't know. I never presumed to... I just sit there with a blank face and pain. But somehow, my awareness of my limitations meant that I never really asked why. And having had all kinds of losses through then, or contemplating larger losses, like the Shoah, any answer that's ever been given has been never gotten close to the magnitude of the question. So as Reb Chaim Brisker used to say, better a good question than a half-baked answer. But it doesn't mean I don't struggle with it. It doesn't mean that I mean, I've never thought to reject God because my father died. But I never thought to doubt, like, what's this all about? But one of the things that I discovered was, and this is something actually later I was actually very happy to see in Dr. Lehman's book as well, that the best thing to do, at least for me, was to work it out and struggle from within. That there is no contradiction between faith and doubt. You can have faith in God. You can have faith in the eternity of Jewish people. You can have faith in your fellow Jew. And still doubt specific Jews. Wonder why God did something. Things. Your questions are not illegitimate. Half-baked answers are not a good idea. But questions are not illegitimate. And you struggle. And over time, sometimes you get insights as to, wow, maybe that's something I got out of it. Or maybe that's something that happened as a result. It was good. Did it have to be that way? I have no idea. It's like chaos theory. You can't figure out the cause between the fluttering of the butterfly's wings and the tsunami at the end of the world. But working from within, I'm able to. It's funny, my ability to have faith and confidence that there is an answer helps me with the doubt. Not in denying it, not in delegitimizing the question, but in being grown up enough to know that you have to struggle and you have to grow and to learn and you have to think. It's working from within. Being Jewish and doing mitzvot and learning Torah, in the broadest sense of the term. So learning Torah does not just mean learning Gemara. There is a huge library of philosophy and thought and ethics and poetry and whatever, which is also can also easily be included in the definition of Torah, which speaks to these specific areas, these specific things. But beyond that, one of the things that distinguishes, I think, one of the things I learned from the Rav, that distinguishes different people's ways of dealing with doubt is that doubt can lead to anger. Doubt can lead to being broken, and it happens all the time. Anger, interesting. A friend of mine, a psychiatrist, once said it's not an emotion, it's an activity. I'm not sure what that means, but I think you'll get that it sort of fits here. The doubt can also be a motivating, not just looking for meaning, but looking for action. In Kol Dodi Dofek, in an essay, his classic manifesto on religious Zionism that the Rav Soloveitchik wrote in the 60s, or gave as a drasha in the 60s, He talks about the Holocaust. He talks about Job. And he says, basically, that the mistake of Job was to ask why. Because not in the sense that he was predicating his entire life on the why. Why? What's wrong with that? Because you'll never get a full answer to the why. You can't get a full answer to the why. I've been an historian. You want to count since I started college? I've been an historian for almost 50 years. And I've engaged hundreds, if not thousands, of historical enterprises and people and events and so on and so forth. And I can honestly tell you that while I know I've always identified some of the reasons that things happen, I've never had the temerity to say that's it. Because there is no just one answer to the question of why does one event happen and not another one. It's always a confluence of factors. You can't wrap your head against all of them. All you can do is think from this point of view, this is what looks determinative. From that point of view, and they're all true. So you'll never get a full why answer. I don't know if the human brain can comprehend a full answer. I mean, hell, we can't keep all of our passwords in our heads. My son just gave me a new program to organize passwords because it makes you crazy. So what Russell Levechik said, and which I follow, again, I'm not just speaking about me. He asked the question that's in our control is, what can we do in order to live with our doubt? And what can we do in order to live with pain and loss? And that you can control. You can find something constructive to not just channel your need, your pain, or your doubt, but rather you can find something to do to make the world a better place. You can do something. Torah mandates actions always. Even if your faith situation is not 100%, but you work within and you do something. Whether it's a case of the Shoah, you volunteer with Holocaust survivors, or you work for memorials, or you know what? One of the great things about Israel is we have the highest percentage of volunteer organizations in the world. Whether it's Yad Sara, or whether it's Yad Eliezer, or whether it's Yechon Menachem, or whether it's the Mishtara, or whether it's Beit Lechem Yehuda, whatever the case might be, there are endless things that we do because we want to help other people, and that's what you do. You help other people, you volunteer to do more, and you channel it by doing it somehow, by doing actually. Take some of the edge off of the doubt because you feel intuitively that you're working through the questions that you have. We're getting to the end. I would also add that I don't know if this is going to help, but I know with me it helped. As I said, this is all very personal for me. When I was a little kid, I mean, I had my faith was pretty pristine, and then you know I got exposed to biblical criticism, and I got exposed. My father died, and all kinds of stuff happened, and you get shaken up. But you got to keep going. That's basically what the Rav was saying. How to deal with doubt. And years later, I found an analysis. I found a comment more that appears in the 16th century Kabbalistic ethical work called the Shnei Luchot Tabrit, the Two Tables of the Covenant, was through the Shalah, it's called, by Rabbi Yeshayahu Levi Horowitz, who came from Prague and then came to Eretz Yisrael. He's actually one of the three people in Jewish culture who has the epithet Hakadosh. One is the Arizal, the Ari Hakadosh, the founder of L'Uriani Kabbalah. The second is Rabbi Shai Levi Horowitz, whose name is the Shlach HaKadosh, otherwise known among the Hasidim, is called the Heilige Shlu. And the third is the Moroccan commentator, Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar, who wrote the book, The Parish on the Torah, the Orach Chaim. He's also called the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. So the Shlach HaKadosh says in his discussion of Tkiyat Shofar, effectively said that the way that the Shofar is structured reflects the way that we should emotionally and intellectually and morally grow Certainly in terms of the high holidays, but also during the year. So when you look at the shofar, when you look at the way we blow shofar, there's tkiah, which is a long blast. Then there's shvarim, or shvarim chua, which are three short blasts, or 9 or 11 shorter blasts, and then a tkiah. It's all one unit. It says, why? Because it's a process. Tkiah is a person who's whole. He's fine. But then he encounters the world, he encounters evil, he encounters questions, and he's broken. And sometimes he gets so broken that he breaks into little pieces. That's the chua. And if the things stop there, he'd just be broken on the floor. But the halacha is that you have to have a chua at the end. A chua at the beginning and a chua at the end. Because at the end of the day, our function is to keep working and working to be able to put together the broken pieces so that we become whole again. But ultimately, the two chuot on the other side of the on each side of that, each unit of blowing shofar are very different. Because the first one is vulnerable. The second one, the second one is steel. So that the struggling with doubt is, you acknowledge the fact that you're broken, that you're shvarim or trua. But you're supposed to, I try to push myself forward towards that integrated and stronger steeled trua, which is the golden life. Now, all of this goes play on within. I am well aware of that. And not everybody can do it. And that's why I said this is all autobiographical. I strongly recommend, again, Rabbi Lam's essay. I strongly recommend reading Kol Dodi Gefolgt by Rav Soloveitchik. I have a bit of a stake in it because the edition that was the translation that's available. Well, if you read it in Hebrew, but if you can't read the Hebrew, the one that's in a very nice sort of brownish maroon covering, I translated and edited with somebody else. So I don't get percentages, but the family does. But and to consider your way in a very very difficult and a very difficult question. So it's talik masa fake in halacha. Yeah, you can get away with it. You can ask the rabbi, and there'll be an answer, and you'll be set. When it comes to emotional doubt, when it comes to blood doubt and belief, there's no, especially today, there's no avoiding it. Say lecha rav, find a teacher to help you, but the only way to do it is face it straight on. The combination of faith, which will hold you up while you deal with your doubts. No need to make hurried decisions. No need to make half-baked answers. Because at the end of the day, good things happen at the end of the day also. I'm not saying that one is for the other. Chalila. Because Ben-Gurion would never have said such a thing, even. But I never get past the fact. I'm always stunned that 3 years after Auschwitz, there was a sovereign Jewish state that was able to defend itself. And thank God it's lasted for 73 years and should last for many centuries to come. So, Chag Yom HaZikaron Mashmuti, Chag Atzmaut Sameach Medinat Yisrael, Chag Post-Corona Medinat Yisrael, and to Kula and to everybody. And we will see you back here next week with a new Mishnah. As usual, please feel free to share this. You can send. I'm going to put this up on the TAIS website, Facebook page, my way, Facebook page, right through Twitter and whatever. If you need to be in touch with me, you know how. And we'll see you. Bye.